Impact Leaders, the podcast on impact leaders, influencers, and institutions supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. And this is your host, JP Dahlman. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. Today we have John Elkington as our guest. Hi, John.
Hello, JP.
Welcome and thank you for being with us today, or I should say having us here at your offices in Somerset House in a wonderful sunny day in London. Very hot.
The Sahara comes to London.
Yeah. I'm in New York as well today, right, and these days. So please allow me to start by saying, you know, what an honor it is to be here. I was just telling you when we were coming up the stairs, so many people just, you know, keep talking to me about you. So I thought that it would be really nice to meet you. And finally, we make it. It took us a bit of a time to coordinate, but we're doing it.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. As a way of an introduction for context and background, I tend to share a bio of our guest, but today is a bit of a challenge, or at least I found it. I picked up in your personal website, it says that you are an advisor, an advocate, an author, a bubblefish or a babelfish, a director, an editor, a professor, and a speaker. So I can only ask you, please tell us, who is John Elkington?
I still don't know. I mean, I had my 70th birthday in June, and I had over 100 people to what was originally conceived to be a birthday party, but became something rather different, which was a look into the next 10 to 15 years. I'm somebody who's always been interested in the future, who's always been interested in history and science and technology and politics and economics, and particularly interested in business and business's role in addressing social and particularly environmental issues. So I'm still trying to work out who I am and what I'm going to be when I grow up. So give me some time and I'll tell you in due course.
I'll come back maybe every 10 years.
Fantastic.
Every 10 years to ask the question. As I was looking at, again, you know, your trajectory and all the experience you have had, I was thinking, you know, so many people tend to say that we should only focus on one thing.
And they're probably right.
So how do you do it? What is your trick?
I don't think I have a trick, and I've never really totally known what I was meant to be doing on this planet of ours. And it's only relatively recently I've started to think I have some idea of what I'm meant to be doing here. And over the decades that I've worked on a range of different issues, I've often felt I'm making it up as I go along. I don't think there's been a career path or anything like it in the areas that I've been interested in. I think there are now. I think people do master's degrees. And yesterday I was at Imperial College talking to about 30 people doing master's and PhDs. But when I started, there wasn't that sort of trajectory. And I'm not sure I would have wanted that either. I've always felt that if I'd been taught at school some of the stuff that I've begun to learn over the years, I'd have lost interest in it. I sort of have to work out things for myself to some degree.
Mm. So you give us a bit of hope of all of us that are still kind of looking and changing continuously, right?
Well, funnily enough, one of the questions I was asked yesterday by one of the faculty members was, so what would be a critical skill you think, I thought, would be relevant to these much younger people? And I think they felt these would be numeracy and ability to mathematically model complex
finance
systems and all of that sort of thing. And my answer was curiosity. I think that if you're going to succeed in an area which is about complex systems and system change and so on, by God, you have to be curious. You have to be learning the whole time. You have to be leaning into the future. You have to be engaging people, many of whom might not want to talk to you to begin with. So, and that was my answer. I'm sure there are many other answers.
Curiosity, and then with this ever-changing world as well, which is, you know, most people think that it's the most dynamic it has ever been, so curiosity to adapt.
Yeah.
Perfect. So we have a bit of a tradition. So we ask this question to all of our guests, which is, what is impact investing? As we were speaking before, you know, it's kind of most of our listeners are in the impact investing kind of arena. But since at the previous episode, we recorded with Martin Rich, the founder of Future Fit Foundation, he referred to you as the father of the triple bottom line, which other people refer to as TBL. Is that something that you relate to as well in terms of the work that you have done? And then the question would be, is impact investing triple bottom line?
Well, let me creep up on the triple bottom line answer. I went to university first time to study economics. I gave it up after 1 year in 1968 because it seemed to have nothing to do with the world that I was then inhabiting, which was full of environmental and social and political challenges. So I'm not particularly numerate. In fact, I've founded four companies since 1978. They all still exist, but I can't even read a balance sheet. But at the same time, I've been pulled into the financial world in many different ways. And I've worked with banks, and I've worked with sort of development finance institutions, and I've worked with socially responsible investment funds continuously for about 25 years, about 8 or 9 of them. I've worked with venture capital funds. But I don't pretend to understand what a lot of these people do. I'm there as a sort of a cross-connector between what they do and a wider world. But I think impact investment has come through very strongly in the last sort of 10 or 15 years. The term wouldn't have been much used before then. And I think it is now seen to be an industrial or sort of a sector. And I think people start to do market valuations and so on. And there are people who professionally feel that they are impact investors. And I think that's a very exciting time in all of this. But, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert on it at all.
Okay. What would be your perception of what it is today perceived as impact investing?
Well, for me, and then we can get into the question of what other people might see it as. For me, it's money learning how to move beyond the Milton Friedman idea that shareholder value is really the ultimate objective and that governments get in the way. For me, money has always been rather a sort of blind organism, which sometimes does good work and sometimes has really unintended consequences. And having grown up with a range of social and environmental movements, I've seen many of those consequences. So for me, impact investment is about people with money or investing other people's money who become increasingly interested in, to some degree concerned about, a range of non-financial issues with the potential to cross-connect with the financial world, to have financial consequences, to be financially material. And so I think this is still an industry very much in formation. I think its mindset is increasingly there, but its methodologies are still embryonic, to put it kindly.
Put it kindly. Perfect. And triple bottom line?
Yeah, I promised that, didn't I? In 1994, so 25 years ago, pretty much exactly, I'd been thinking for some time about a concern I had, which was that if you looked at the business-to-business platforms, and there were very many fewer then than there are now, but there was one called the Business Council for Sustainable Development, what became the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And they talked then about eco-efficiency, and that's absolutely fine. And if you're an engineer or an efficiency expert, it makes a bunch of sense. And the idea was that you could make or save money by doing the right thing on natural resources or environment or pollution or whatever. And I thought, you know, that's fine, but there's a bigger agenda out there. And so I think that eco-efficiency was about the financial and environmental elements. What if, in addition to the financial dimension, you brought in the economic value side? And what if, in addition to the financial and even the economic and environmental, you brought in the social side? So, for example, if you're Walmart, you may well embrace the environment in order to save money and squeeze your suppliers, to squeeze carbon and other problems out of their supply chains. But when it becomes social, then it becomes complicated because you have sort of social conditions of labor and wages and all the rest of it. So the triple bottom line was economic, social, and environmental. That was 1994. In 1995, I came up with a slight popularization, which was people, planet, and profit. And then last year in June, I recalled both. I basically through the Harvard Business Review said, and apparently HBR says this is the first time it's ever been done with a management concept. Nobody has ever recalled a management concept. So I recalled the triple bottom line and said, I'm proud of it. It's great that thousands of companies around the world are doing triple bottom line, non-financial sustainability reporting. It's great that there are now several thousand B corporations formally chartered around the triple bottom line. But I think it's been misinterpreted. The idea was always that it was about a new form of capitalism, a new approach to economics, about system change. And what it's become, for perfectly understandable reasons, is a bit more about trade-offs. How do we balance off against these three different dimensions? And so the idea of the recall was just to slightly shock people into rethinking. And now I think we've got an answer to it. Now I think I can see how the triple bottom line can be reintroduced, not that it was ever really taken away. People continue to use it, but reintroduced in a way that I think is more appropriate to what FutureFit would describe, the FutureFit Foundation would describe as system value.
Perfect. Okay, so it's, I understand. So it's more about system. Just to repeat what you were saying, so it's just about more systemic change to the root rather than just a balancing of, you know, just to use the word, you know, the books or the way that people operate their companies.
Well, accountants do good work, and we're better off because of the work that accountants do. But, you know, that's numbers-based, and it's within an existing system, and it's plotting performance as defined by the current system. There has been growing interest in recent years in what's called integrated accounting and reporting, where you bring together different forms of capital, physical, financial, human, intellectual, social, natural forms of capital. And I've been involved in some of that. I was involved in setting up the Global Reporting Initiative. I was on the council, the International Integrated Reporting Council, for 3 years. But what worries me about a lot of that integration work is that it focuses on bringing together different forms of capital, not lots of different layers of the global economy right out to the biosphere. So for me, proper integration would, yes, integrate different forms of capital, but it would also, and even in some cases, put financial values on non-financial forms of capital. But it would also take you from the field, the farm, the factory, the fishery, right the way through supply chains to individual companies, out into the ecosystem of different business and financial actors, and then ultimately right out through the national economy, international global economy, to the biosphere, the oceans, the atmosphere, and so on. Now, no one really, that's true, that's integration as I understand it. And we're not anywhere like that yet. But I think if the triple bottom line is going to deliver real systemic value over time, that's the form of integration that we've got to pursue.
Understand, thanks. And just for my clarification, you recall it, you put it back out there.
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. No. Then you said that you did release a new concept as well?
Well, in January of 2020, on the 10th of January, we're having a big event to relaunch the triple bottom line. The event is co-hosted with Aviva Investors, so a big financial institution. And this is also to mark a part way point in what we've called tomorrow's capitalism inquiry. So having done the product recall on the triple bottom line, we thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to engage some leadership companies in thinking through what might need to be done next? So leadership companies like The Body Shop, who'd been in a leadership position for a very long time, Unilever, a range of other people. So the triple bottom line we've been thinking about, but it was just in recent days, I've just finished a new book and sent it off to the publisher yesterday. And right in the final paragraph, I think I've solved my problem of what comes after the triple bottom line.
Okay. Can we say the name of the book just in case?
Well,
it's not out there, but it's
the book's not there. Okay. It won't be out until January.
Okay.
And the title of the book is Green Swans. Some of your listeners will know of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who came up with the notion of the black swan.
Yes.
And the black swan, as you know, is a sort of catastrophe. It's something that's not easily predictable, that has an impact on a much bigger scale than most people would have imagined. And it's afterwards we really struggle to understand what's just happened
and will have to us. Completely.
So we don't learn from our mistakes terribly well. So the black swan takes you exponentially down. I mean, it's a negative exponential. The green swan is something that potentially at least takes you exponentially upwards. So it's a positive trajectory. And there are examples of it. They're harder to get to than the black swans. But we're moving into exponential times. And I think you're going to see more swans, you know, black, gray, as some people call ones that are more predictable, or green. So the purpose of the book, to look at the future of capitalism through this sort of exponential lens. And then within that, the notion of what follows the triple bottom line has been a critical theme. And right at the end of the book, I sort of raised the question of what we're actually talking about is the triple bottom line, but refurbished, refreshed, brought up to date. And for me, the way that we might do that is to say, imagine a 3x3 matrix, and at the top you've got sort of the triple bottom line. So people, planet, profit, economy, society, environment. That's your sort of columns. And then in the rows, what you've got is three things again. Responsibility, which is where most of the focus of the corporate social responsibility in a way corporate sustainability movements have focused. Now, responsibility is always evolving. So now we've got things like cybersecurity and so on, and, you know, responsibility data, positions having to be taken there. The second one, so responsibility is great, but that's in a way the baseline. That's the bedrock. That's almost now a hygiene factor for big, known, high reputation companies. The second level is resilience. So despite everything we've been doing over the decades, the climate emergency is pressing in with ever greater urgency. And if you're a Japanese company, you're suddenly finding it's not just an earthquake hitting you, it's suddenly in Thailand, you've got extended supply chains and massive flooding in Thailand because, again, climate factors. So resilience, whether you are a company with supply chains or whether you're a city, that factor is now becoming very much more important. So what is the best way of developing economic resilience, societal resilience, community level resilience, environmental resilience, and so on? So that's the second level. And that's, I think, where the debate has begun to go now. The third level is around regeneration. Because in a way, the other two levels are simply making a bad situation a little bit less worse than it would have been. And there have been people warning about this for a while. So you're trying to do less bad rather than reverse the trend entirely. And so, again, what does economic regeneration look like? What does societal regeneration or environmental regeneration, and how do you deliver projects, initiatives, value, which integrate across all of those different dimensions? So that sounds a little bit more complicated than the original triple bottom line, which God knows was complicated enough. But I think if people start to think in that way, I'd be quite comfortable in re-releasing this life form back into the wild, the triple bottom line.
I hear you. But it's still all very hopeful, which is very nice, very kind of positive and hopeful in terms of...
I sort of am hopeful. At times, younger colleagues say I'm a bit like an Old Testament prophet in the sense that I think 8 to 10 billion people on a very small planet with economics that really hasn't woken up to the crisis in which we find ourselves is a recipe for disaster. And I think we are headed very rapidly into that disaster. And I talk increasingly about a historic U-bend where, a bit like underneath your sink, you have a sort of a U-shaped structure. And we're coming out of a series of cycles, historic cycles, technology cycles, political cycles, the post-Bretton Woods, global institutional structures, the 45 to 50-year information technology cycle. And that all of these things are sort of coming to the end at the same time. And I think populism and some of the, you know, public anxieties, the uncertainties, the confusion that we see, it's no accident and it's not going to go away in any short order. And I think we need a very different form of political leadership. And I don't particularly think, I mean, increasingly people are looking to business leaders, CEOs, to step up and fill that gap. I think they're going to have to do a bit of that, but I really don't want them doing that long term, because they're not democratically elected. Who the hell are they to decide what a society really needs? Although they can play a useful role.
Just because you mentioned, are you a religious person by any ways? Or?
I could be described as about as far as you could get from religious as it would be possible to get. And I only say that because I was brought up in places like Northern Ireland, where I was brought up between the Catholics and the Protestants. I was brought up in Cyprus, where there were ethnic divides across Turks and Greeks and all the rest of it. And then I was in Israel, and this was all in the 50s. And the one thing I learned that is religions are an excuse for tribalism doesn't mean that spirituality is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. And it doesn't mean that in the core of the founding principles of most religions, there are profoundly good and valuable insights and the rest of it. But I'm not religious now.
Thank you. And since you mentioned, I'm just going to kind of jump to one of the questions I had, which was, you mentioned climate emergency, populism, and you know, one of the initiatives that we kind of spoke before as well was related to the extension of rebellion and what's been happening, you know, in this country, in the UK. And so I picked up that, you know, before the, in one of the notes that you made, one of the posts on LinkedIn, that you met with the co-founder, you know, Gail Bradbrook, and then, then you had the idea of writing this letter to the Times, and then you have all the signatories, you know, for the kind of the XR business kind of group. And coincident, well, using some of that and inspired by some of what was happening as well, I wrote an article because I realized in my time now, how I look at things, that there's a complete disconnect between what is happening, you know, with people like Extinction Rebellion, you know, the politicians, you know, people in general, and all the investment funds and the oil companies, right, all the fossil fuel companies. But then people keep telling me this has been happening, and you mentioned it right at the beginning of the conversation, this has been happening for 30, 40, 50 years, and it seems like it's all repeating again and again.
Well, these things do go around in cycles or great sort of spirals, and you have periods where there's some sort of breakthrough politically where the green movement or the environmental movement before it or the conservation movement before that or human rights or civil rights or whatever break through, and then it goes downwards. There's something different, though, I think, going on at the moment, and it is the way in which younger people are waking up to a range of different issues and that they're prepared to take action. And the reason why I invited Gail in, I'd never met her. I was beginning to hear quite a lot about Extinction Rebellion. This is about 5 or 6 weeks before the protests started in London. I was immensely impressed by her. I mean, she's got a PhD in physical biology, so she's bright. But she's got this astonishing, sort of almost Gandhi-like quality of peaceful intent and embrace of the wider world. I was very forcefully impressed by that. And when the protest started, and, you know, the Waterloo Bridge is just right outside our front door.
100 meters.
No, we would talk to the protesters this morning, and there were grandmothers there, and there were younger people, and the mood was fantastic for day after day after day. And then something started to change when in Oxford Street and around Trafalgar Square, some of the retail businesses started to protest or complain that their sales were being hit. You know, one of the papers had a figure of £12 million of business lost in the retail sector. And so I was asked whether I would do something to get a different business voice into the proceedings. And the idea of doing a letter to the Times is relatively simple. It's something we sort of sometimes think of doing in this country. So I did it, and I got, I think, 23 business leaders and CEOs to sign up to it. And I think that was very useful. I think people were quite struck in the mainstream business world, because suddenly they were thinking, because our argument was, look, we regret the impact on today's business, but if you look into the deep future, the cost to our economies is going to be off the scale greater. So listen to these people. Don't dismiss them because you see them as troublemakers. Pay attention, because this is a serious agenda, and we as CEOs and other business leaders take them seriously and are trying to understand what they're trying to tell us. So I think this is an immensely exciting time. And I think it's that bridge between the generations. I think younger people, when they switch on, can have a quite disproportionate impact on their parents and somewhat older generations. And we've seen that just time and time again now in business. It's very rare now to go into a company and meet people, particularly in the sustainability space, who don't quite quickly say, one of my children was one of the climate strikers in Germany or in Finland or, you know, Britain or wherever it was. So
Yeah, well, so I have,
exciting.
I have two daughters, 13 and 10, and the 13-year-old, she wanted to come.
Yeah.
You know, we live outside of London, but, you know, she wanted to come as well. So, it's, yes.
Yeah.
And I picked up that obviously you have, you know, some of the well-known names of some, what some people would call the converter, right? So a former CEO of Unilever, Paul Mann, the founder of Eco Tree City, I think it is, Dale Beans, the Eden Project, Sir Tim Smith.
They were natural supporters.
Yeah, and those. Yeah. Do you have many more people that are not the ones that we see or hear all the time? Or?
Yeah, the funny thing was that every so often in my working life, I don't call it a career because, as I said, I've never had a proper career. But every so often I do something that in a way looks suicidal or a bit weird. And this letter to the Times is one of those because we were identifying ourselves with a rebellion. I mean, you know, people who really don't terribly like capitalism, don't trust business. But the odd thing was that since that letter went out, we've had a number of very major companies in different countries across Europe, but one from Japan, getting in touch and saying, will you come and talk to our board? Now, this is something that's beginning to happen in the wider world, which we really need to understand. And would you come and help us do that? So that was not why we did it. It's a sort of counterintuitive outcome, but it's one that we're happy to follow through with.
Yeah. I may as well mention this because I didn't know, but I think it's the government of Japan launched this concept called Society 5.0. I don't know if you heard about it, but they are kind of trying to come up with a design of what this new world should look like and what are the things that we should
do. I didn't know about it, but it sounds very Japanese.
It's very, very interesting. So I highly recommend that to people to listen or to go and search and read about it. So that people, again, try to relate and understand a bit more of, you know, some of the things that your companies do, you know, how you help, you know, potentially this company that came from Japan. So you have, and I picked just two. So I picked Sustainability and Volans, if that's okay. And then what I understand is that, and again, to use a practical example, is that you are the honorary chairman now, and you founded Sustainability in 1987, which I think you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I also recommend people to go to the website. It's excellent, sustainability.com. And it says, you know, that we inspire and enable businesses to lead the way to a sustainable economy. And you do consulting, think tank, and like a member network, I think.
Well, it's true. Since 1978, I've set out or co-founded four companies, and they all still exist in one way or another. Sustainability was the third, and I was involved for a very long time, over 25, 30 years. But that company was sold to a much bigger company in January, and at that point, my formal involvement ended. You know, I'm immensely proud of the work that we have done there. I'm immensely proud of the work that they continue to do, but I have no continuing oversight of what Sustainability do, apart from, like the rest of the people, knowing people there and having friends there. I can't speak on their behalf. Volans was, you know, we set up as a spin-out from Sustainability and the World Economic Forum, where a couple of the people came from. And the idea was very similar in many ways to Sustainability. But we just take, I think, slightly bigger risks because we're smaller and are minded to do so.
Sorry, talking about Volans now? No.
Yeah.
And the one thing perhaps I was going to also share, you know, although it has been since, you know, the sale, they did the report with the 2030 vision.
Yeah.
And this is a report of AI and SDGs that I thought was excellent. And there were also 2030 vision, they were partnering with Cognition X at the COGX event.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that, which was very interesting. So very much on the from food on, you know, what the impact can be to deliver the SDGs faster, which I thought was very interesting. And again, I thought I'd mention for people to know. So then if we talk about Volans then.
Yeah.
So you are executive chairman and co-founder. Also, the website is, you know, excellent. I must admit, you got very good user experience and information.
That's good to hear.
At Volans.com. And it says, Volans helps leaders make sense of the emerging future. You know, you conduct inquiries into our planet's most wicked problems. And you help businesses drive positive change and at an unprecedented pace and scale. And you do, you say, like a hub of research, collaboration, and action, it says, right? And then in terms of the work, you do kind of an array of activities, right?
Yeah.
I picked up there that you have, you know, kind of information about new carbon economy, tomorrow's capitalism, and you have Project Breakthrough, which is something that is quite collective and cohesive and I don't know if it's complex, but what would you tell us about Volans and what you do with your clients?
Well, you mentioned Project Breakthrough, and that really came from a conversation I had with Lisa Kingo when she took over the new head of the UN Global Compact about 3 years ago. And Lisa was somebody I'd worked with at Novo Nordisk from the late 80s, 1980s onwards. And so I knew her quite well. And we were talking about what business-to-business platforms like the Global Compact needed to do next. And part of what I was saying, you mentioned sustainability is artificial intelligence work. Part of what I said in response was, I think we need to get out and engage the people and the organizations and the funders and so on who are driving the new economy, the new technologies. And so that's Internet of Everything and autonomous vehicles, synthetic biology, and all of the stuff that's being driven by digitalization. And we about 2.5 years ago, we did quite a big tour of Silicon Valley and Los Angeles. And what we found was fascinating work being done and people beginning to take bits of the Sustainable Development Goals agenda. So, for example, Singularity University and the XPRIZE Foundation increasingly talking, and Google's X facility talking about what they call global challenges. So there are 12 of those, not 17 of the Sustainable Development Goals. Mm-hmm. Just last week, I was talking to a key person from Google's X Lab, just called X now. And she was saying increasingly now, instead of having a program that was called Global Challenges, that's now becoming the central framework within which they do everything that they do. So even in that relatively short period of time, there's been quite an interesting shift in the way some of these pioneers and innovators think. But it was really quite striking because after we'd been to Mountain View and seen people like Google X and Singularity University and so on, with Lisa, we invited one of the key people from Singularity University to the UN Global Compact Summit in New York. And his name's Nick Hahn. He now chairs the Global Challenges work at Singularity University. So he came along, did a speech. And afterwards, a couple of corporate people, part of the corporate membership of the Global Compact, came up to me and said, why have we got somebody like that here talking about exponential innovation, exponential technology? What's that got to do with sustainability? And I said, interesting. You know, if we'd been bringing in Greenpeace 35, 40 years ago, as I then did, you'd have said exactly the same. If we were talking about bringing in Muhammad Yunus and social entrepreneurs 20 years ago, you said exactly the same thing. And so what we're trying to do is bring the future in to the point where you can actually meet it and get a sense of where that's headed. And it's not just passive. I mean, it's not just simply use these technologies and you have solutions to sustainable development. It's unless we get into those worlds and we start to influence some of those innovators now, we're going to get unintended consequences that we really don't like. So, you know, we'll only have ourselves to blame. So let's get in there. And that was the idea of Project Breakthrough.
Okay, understand. And again, just maybe to disclaim, I take advantage. And so I'm an impact investment kind of partner to COGEX. Yeah. And I went around talking to hedge funds, investment funds, and impact investors and telling them, look, you know, come to COGEX to see, you know, what our company is doing with technology today to see how we can help, you know, some of the investments, some of the companies you can invest in, et cetera. And most people were looking at me like, you know, so we have.
That's sometimes a bad thing, but generally I find it's a good thing because it means you're a little bit ahead of the curve and you can sort of do some form of arbitrage. And it's funny because when we set up, we were a very small organization. We set up an advisory council of 12 people, and there was the CEO of IDEO, the design firm. There was somebody who'd been an astronaut and a cosmonaut. One of the early members, too, was somebody, Professor Eccles, then at the Harvard Business Review, now Said Business School. And he's just done a piece in Harvard Business Review called The Investor Revolution. It's very interesting because what he's saying is that the financial markets have been completely opposed, really, apart from SRI funds and some small venture capital funds and so on. They've been really quite hostile to the sustainability agenda for a very long time. It's really shifting and it's beginning to shift quite fast. Thinking about many of these investment firms and funds and so on is that they don't have a lot of sunk capital or assets and so on. Once they start to move, they can move relatively quickly. So I think it's a very exciting time
in
all of this. And I think the financial markets are in the process of switching on in a way that we sort of haven't got used to expecting.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I think that they're looking at the effect that's potentially having on valuations and the cost of capital. And obviously, you know, that's where it hurts, so they have to start. But I think that most people are actually becoming, even the change in the culture in some financial services, you know, has become a bit more human, some people say.
And I think the fact that you've got banks like ING, I think, reducing the cost of capital to companies that have good sustainability programs, that is that thin edge of that sort of wedge of change that's starting to come into operation.
Just on that, actually, I picked up here a phrase that is kind of a quote from you. I'm going to read it, that's okay. So it says, "We have a hardwired culture problem in business, finance, and markets, whereas CEOs, CFOs, and other corporate leaders move heaven and earth to ensure that they hit their profit targets. The same is very rarely true on their people and planet targets." So what can other financial institutions of the world and impact investors wannabe can do differently, you think?
That quotation comes from the Harvard Business Review product recall piece on the triple bottom line. And you can diagnose a problem without necessarily knowing exactly what the solutions are going to be. But one of the solutions, I think, in terms of capital markets and financial institutions understanding all of this, is that if I go back 15 or 20 years and I think about the people I would have met then as investors, anyone with an interest in sustainability would have been a complete mutation at that time. They would have been independently wealthy and could afford to do whatever it was, or otherwise they'd have been ruled out of court completely. And now there's a generation who broadly get this stuff. They don't know quite what to do with it always, but they'd like to do something. They'd like to find a way to do something meaningful and show a good financial return. And I think that psychological shift, that's also an emotional shift as well, is profoundly important. And if you layer in on top of that what's going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years, I mean, in a couple of days, we'll have the hottest day and night in London ever.
Yeah. France
has just had its hottest day, which was 45.9 degrees ever. Australia's changed the colors on its heat maps because they no longer embrace what's going on there. You don't have to be a reinsurer or an insurer who's picking up on the risk on the related sort of natural disasters and so on. You look at Bloomberg News, you see a company like Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, going bankrupt. Why? I mean, I visited them in the early 1980s, a very major electricity utility, sometimes doing some really good work in renewables and so on. Answer to the question why is that one of their installations threw some sparks, which set some of the fires in California, which among other things burnt down the town of Paradise and from memory killed over 80 people. And that wasn't the first time it had happened to them, but it was the first time it had really hit at that sort of, with that level of impact. And why did that happen? Because California is drying out because of climate change. So we're in a much more combustible, in many senses, you know, economically, politically, and also environmentally, environment than we were even a few years back.
I see. Yeah, I can only agree. And now it's kind of all linking as well in terms of other things that I read, you know, about some of your history, kind of when you turned 65, that you mentioned that we're entering this breakthrough decade, right? And now you have the project breakthrough and you can see everything that is happening in all the different aspects, right? So we're halfway now. What do you think is coming, you know, in the next? What are the key?
It's very easy to sort of talk about this decade or that decade or this year or that year. And the idea of the breakthrough decade was just simply that if you take a 10-year timescale from where we then happened to be, it's going to be a very interesting time. In the same way, I think the 2020s, and probably even a more powerful way, are going to be an extraordinary period of collective evolution, evolution of markets, evolution of business, evolution of capitalism, politics, and so on, because we're going to have no choice in the matter. And I think the science has been saying for a very long time, we've got some major challenges. The science is now saying we've got 10 years and, you know, gradually coming down in order to get this sorted. Otherwise, it's going to get completely out of control. I think our species is at times self-deluded, myopic, sort of borderline idiotic, but it's not clinically stupid for generations. And I think we're in the process of waking up. And I think once that happens, people will start to point their fingers every which way and say, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you tell us this was going to happen? The answer is that people have been told for a very long time. Mm. But the penny is only just dropping now. And that's as true for politicians as it for ordinary people. But the fact that it's dropping with younger people now, I think, is what changes the political equation or balance. I'm very hopeful about that. I think there are risks too. I think that there is a risk that older people will just say, you know, we tried, we were environmentalists. Really, they weren't. They drove sport utility vehicles and all the rest of it. But they'll say, we tried, now over to you. And I think that's incredibly dangerous. I think older people have wealth and connections and influence that younger people don't have.
Yeah.
So this has to be a pan-generational project.
I agree. I completely agree with you, because it's the only way to scale, you know, faster, right?
Yeah.
And we're kind of coming close to the end of the episode, but I just wanted to ask you a couple more questions. And one of those was around kind of identifying and measuring impact. You know, we talked about so many things. And
yeah.
Is there anything, and I know that we can talk about many of these subjects for a long time, but is there kind of any one thing or a couple of things that you think that we should focus on in terms of, you know, measuring?
Well, I think I declared a weakness earlier on, which is that, you know, I'm not particularly numerate. But one of the projects that I found particularly interesting recently has been working with Novartis, the Swiss pharmaceutical company, on looking at how you put a financial valuation on the triple bottom line performance of its business units in different countries and against different issues and so on. And, you know, that's challenging, but it's fascinating. I declare a reservation. I think there are always going to be limitations on how far you can put a properly accounted for financial value on many social and environmental or ethical questions. But I think it's something we've got to do if we're going to bring all of this into the mainstream. I have one other problem in this area, which is that, as I said earlier on, I'm interested in system change. And I think measurement often takes you into the guts of the current system rather than into what's going to replace it. And very often it's very difficult to measure and account for the sorts of changes that are needed to drive proper system change. So I don't have antibodies to measurement, but I don't want to spend most of my life there, because I don't think some of the things that we are in the process of doing, and who knows which way they'll turn out, but I don't think they're easy to measure. I don't think they're easy to report out on. You know, I love the whole impact investment movement and the aspirations and ambitions in that world. But there's something about me that doesn't want to be pinned down like Gulliver by everyone else's metrics and indicators and key performance indicators and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I want to try new stuff. And sometimes measurement gets in the way.
Okay. And it's something that I can have heard a few people that are actually making it happen and making, you know, instigating change, that, you know, it's about trying to come up with the actions, with the plans, and actually helping, you know, people and environment, rather than just focusing on the measurement.
It's instinctive and intuitive. Yeah. And, you know, for example, if I tried to put measurements and metrics and performance indicators around, do we engage with Extinction Rebellion or do we not, I would not have gone near Extinction Rebellion given conventional metrics. You have to do, to some degree, what feels right. And sometimes then the metrics fall into place afterwards. Sometimes they don't.
Okay. And I was going to ask you a little bit about you, which I tend to do, but obviously, and how you evolved to do what you do, but it's clear now that you didn't plan for it.
No.
So I think there was maybe a couple of, obviously, events through your life. I picked up again one specific one, like in 1978, I think, that you were invited by Max Nicholson and David Layton to join and set up Environmental Data Services.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of maybe a beginning of something. But I was going to ask you, are there any pivotal points that you remember perhaps? And then most importantly as well, maybe some pivotal people that have helped you and inspired you.
Well, on my website, I list over 100 people who've one way
And that's johnelkington.com, by the way.
Yeah,
yes.
But I've been immensely privileged, and partly in talking to these young people at Imperial College last night in recommending curiosity, I was saying, and don't just be passively curious, get in touch with people mm-hmm. that you admire or want to learn from, and just see if they'll see you. And one of the things I found throughout my life is that people have been prodigiously kind in giving me time. And they might be science fiction authors, they might be Nobel Prize winners, all sorts of people. Yeah, and I think people are much more open than we sometimes give them credit for. And you mentioned Environmental Data Services, or ENDS. Yes, we set that up in 1978. But you know, I can't say there was a moment where magically Max Nicholson, somebody I admire immensely, one of the founders of World Wildlife Fund and hundreds of NGOs and so on, he didn't magically get in touch with me. I'd been writing for 5 years for New Scientist about what a magazine, about what business was doing in the environmental space. He'd seen that and then invited me to join the ENDS and lead the ENDS team. But it was a challenge because it took us 9 months to get the first company to even talk to us, even though we had a parent company that was hugely well respected in the industrial relations
How
space.
Long is it?
9 months. And that was ringing companies every day and saying, we want to talk to you about what you're doing on safety, health and environment and so on. And they just wouldn't. They felt anything with an environmental label was coming for their throats. And it was the first one opened up. I did that piece in the magazine that we were doing. And in very short order, lots of others opened up. So looking backwards, you could sort of see a pattern. You think it was almost inevitable. But when you were looking forward, when we were starting, it didn't look inevitable at all.
So it's time. I say that sometimes, and I'm learning myself, right? It's time, patience, and value, right? Value creation, which helps.
Well, I think the biggest lesson probably I've learned from the people I've worked with over time is that what looks impossible today has a tendency over time to become inevitable, but it doesn't always happen in the same brains. I mean, the same brain that sees it as impossible is not necessarily going to see it as inevitable, but there's a generational shift, and it's no longer just a generation across 33 years or whatever human generation it is. In business, you get a rotation of people, a churn of people within 4 or 5 years, and sometimes even sooner. So that generational shift is happening much faster and much more urgently. And I think there's an inevitability now building around a really transformative change agenda, which 10 years ago would have looked absolutely insane if you were trying to predict something like that. We have no option. We're being forced into that. And it's going to be great fun, and it's a huge opportunity as well.
I agree with that as well. And of all these people and all these years that you have met so many leaders, is there kind of one characteristic aside from, let's say, curiosity and perhaps some kind of positivity?
I mean, so many.
So many.
It's been such...
So another 100-item list, yeah.
Well, I mentioned science fiction authors. Well, I had read a book called Dune when I was at university as part of a sociology of religion course. You asked the question whether I was religious. Mm-hmm. I partly did sociology of religion because I wanted to look at that as a sort of a phenomenon. And so Frank Herbert's book was there, and it's the most astonishing science fiction book. It's one of the absolute classics. So anyway, I wanted to meet him, and he lived in Washington State, Pacific Northwest. I had family there, and for about 3 or 4 years, every time I was going there, I'd get in touch with him and find through his publishers and find we somehow couldn't meet. And finally, I was coming back from the Pacific Northwest. He was in London, about to go back to the Pacific Northwest. He said, come and see me in my hotel, and I did. And we had one of the most extraordinary conversations of my entire life. And that was about 2 years with his wife. Both of them died about within the next 3 or 4 years. But he was somebody who had sort of stumbled across the environment relatively early on. And so he asked me where I'd been in Oregon and Washington State. And I said, we've gone to this extraordinary place in Oregon. Never heard of it. Stumbled across it. It was called Dune City. And it was a very small hamlet, very small village. And he said, how strange. He said, that was where in 1944, I think, he went as a cub reporter, a junior reporter from a Seattle-based paper called the Post Intelligence. And that's where he'd had the idea of Dune, a desert planet, and so on, because he was actually there to report on dune stabilization projects, because you know the dunes were coming inland at a time when food production was quite important in the middle of the war. he just had this idea. But then as he traveled up and down the West Coast, he started to look at the what was happening to the environment, what was happening to the forests, what was happening to the coastlines and so on. And he became a really, really profound environmentalist. And there was something in that conversation which I can't even begin to put my finger on, but it was almost like an exchange of plasma or something that is, it's almost spiritual. I mean, it's really peculiar. And I love them both. I love them in the instant. And it was a phenomenal opportunity. But I wouldn't have got there if I hadn't just kept pushing and trying to find a time to connect.
Yeah. So things do take time, right? But you have to be persistent. Perfect. Any last call to action?
I don't know. I mean, as I mentioned, June was my 70th birthday. I do feel that the next 10 to 15 years are going to be by far the most interesting in my entire working life. Part of what I've been going through is trying to work out how I best play into that period of the future. And in fact, you ask about extraordinary people. One of the people I met in the 1970s was Buckminster Fuller, who, you know, extraordinary innovator, technologist, came up with the geodesic dome. Many talked about spaceship Earth before anyone else. And I had breakfast with him in all of places, at Reykjavik. And I look back at the conversation I had with that man that morning, and I think, again, a profound influence. But one of the things that he told me was that he had a nervous breakdown at one stage. And he basically said he went through a process of unplugging his brain, just unhooking everything he assumed, everything he thought he knew. And he went through that process, and out of it came this different, transformed, extraordinary man. Now, I'm not going through anything quite like that, but I do think this is a process, a period of time when we've got to go through a process of thinking about not just how we take ourselves forward into this transformed future, but how we change ourselves sufficiently to be able to deliver the sort of changes, the nature and the scale of change that's going to be needed.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you, JP.
It's a real privilege.
It's a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate your time very, very much. So it is a bye for now. And until our next episode of Impact Leaders, I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. And please remember to check our partners' websites for upcoming events. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.